A family office often begins when the original patriarch, perhaps a highly successful businessman, assigns the job of keeping track of his personal affairs to a trusted administrator. This includes monitoring dividends and income, verifying and paying bills, updating insurance, handling chores to do with his house, and the like. Eventually, the tycoon's wife and children may use the apparatus. Then, in response to demands from the family, the office adds clever ways of getting things done. It has a favorite travel agency and limo rental company, favorite treatment in particular restaurants, and ties with Claridge's and the Plaza Athenae. It will know a reliable theater ticket broker, party caterer, moving company, handyman, and have a good relationship with an employment agency for domestics. In time, the patriarch's accountant hires a secretary and takes on his own assistant. It's easy for the family to get addicted to not having to pay bills and balance checkbooks, so the office becomes progressively more indispensable. Indeed, thanks to its convenience, the second generation may never learn how to write a check, read a bank statement, or follow a budget. Eventually, the patriarch starts to worry about what will happen when he is no longer there to guide the family. Having noted the unworldliness of his children, which he has helped to bring about, he will probably put their inheritance into trusts. He then adds a family lawyer and an investment specialist to the team. When he dies, the manager of the office finds himself in charge of things. If the office has developed strong investment skills, everything should carry on well enough. If, on the contrary, it has evolved into essentially an accounting and hand-holding operation of the obsequious sort, it may well lose the toughness of mind required to make money with money. Perhaps at this point we start to see some weakening of the moral fiber of the family, infantilization, and a corresponding increase in the muscle of the office. Here's a tale from my own experience, disguised slightly. A pair of Cleveland businessmen founded a tube manufacturing company. They were highly successful. The second generation continued to build the company. The third generation lost interest in business and sold the company over the heads of management to a German group for $30 million. The Germans then discovered that they couldn't run the company from a distance and sold it back via a leveraged buyout to six key executives at about the price they had bought it for 3 years earlier. These executives made several moves that they had been restrained from performing before they were owners. After barely 18 months, they resold the improved company to a New York Stock Exchange corporation for approximately $100 million, making themselves a profit of about $70 million. The executives all became wealthy, and clients of ours, as it happened. The third and fourth generation children of the original founders are fit to be tied. Now we are helping the families of the six executives to set up trusts and charitable foundations in such a manner that their children will escape the enfeebling result of too much money that befell the founding family. They hope. Since right before their eyes is the depressing example of that dynasty, whose loss of vigor created the opportunity for our clients, and since they are highly intelligent and able, they should succeed in this delicate problem if anybody can, for a generation or two, anyway. In any event, if by degrees the family loses its spunk, the office will usually also begin to stagnate. The personnel become older and less imaginative. Providing prompt and accurate accounts becomes a higher virtue than foreseeing dangers and seizing opportunities. Some of the more alert family members will start wanting to make their own arrangements. If trust provisions lock them into the office, they may become irritable, like a chained dog. Otherwise, many family offices discover the same solution: admit outside clients and let any family members leave who want to. The service will thus be kept competitive both in price and in performance. In any event, such a family office has now emerged from its chrysalis and metamorphosed into an investment counsel firm. Originally, many investment counselors limited their advice to suggesting whether you should be in stocks or bonds or mortgages. They have come quite a way since those days. Now a full-service firm tells you which stocks or bonds to buy and handles taxes, real estate, venture capital, dozens of things. There seems to be an inverse relationship between the investment acumen of a firm and its skill in trusts, taxes, and other aspects of personal finance. A family office can be perfect at handling executorships, paying bills, doing taxes, but will not have the investment skill of a money management firm that is dependent on performance to build its name. Sometimes, like Charles Pratt and Company, it will farm out the investment functions altogether. Other than that, there is no one mode that governs. Styles in firms range from opulent to shabby, old-fashioned to trendy, aggressive to passive, investment-driven to personal service-driven. Less and less, however, are the big investment counsel firms or bank trust departments really interested in providing the hand-holding kind of family office services. One reason is the explosive growth of corporate pension fund management, which has drawn off many of the abler practitioners. It's hard to give equal weight to the problems of a family whose accounts total $400,000 and to a $50 million pension fund you're also looking after. It's also hard for banks to provide truly personal banking services just because of their size and their rapid personnel turnover. Firms can, however, provide unique services to their clients. Investment counselors regularly have to extract their clients from failing venture capital deals. I'm sure that all of my peers in this profession have had such cases. Lawrence Coolidge, a Boston investment counselor, describes another variation of this problem. A client came to his office accompanied by the leader of a cult he was on the point of joining. He came to pick up his stocks and bonds. He wanted to turn them over to the cult, which required a vow of poverty. Coolidge invited the client into his office. While the Swami cooled his heels outside, the client, at Coolidge's insistence, executed a deed of gift then and there. He achieved the objective of poverty, but for the benefit of his family, not the cult. Coolidge's firm, by the way, along with others, encourages clients to form revocable trusts, a handy means of hanging on to capital. There are two main kinds of trust, irrevocable and revocable. In the former, one permanently turns property over to independent trustees who manage it in the interest of beneficiaries. A husband often leaves the income from his estate to his wife, with the principal to his children or grandchildren. Such trusts frequently produce considerable tax savings. Revocable trusts are a way for an individual to package himself financially for management purposes. Many family offices are fond of revocable trusts and have each family member create one, which is then managed by the trustees. This permits a relatively carefree existence. If you feel like embarking on a world cruise, off you go. The trustees pay the bills and take care of everything while you're away. Of course, this costs money and requires an extra tax return. Why bother? One of the best reasons is that it interposes a level of control, a break between the individual and the fortune. Have found enchanting chalet in Barilosh, cables the excited beneficiary, only $200,000 reduced from $400,000. Unwise, cables back the trustee gloomily. The grantor could just dissolve the trust and buy the chalet, but somehow never does. An imprudent girl beneficiary becomes enamored of a Greek playboy on the Riviera. He wants her to put $800,000 into a marina on Corfu. "I'd love to, Giannis," breathes the infatuated damsel. "But I've got to ask the office. We always ask the office." By the time the trustees' squad of glassy-eyed deal killers have brought realism to the cash flow projections, our young lady should discover whether Giannis is really interested in her or just her bank account. This example suggests the quasi-sacerdotal function with which the family office sometimes becomes invested. The office, like a Shinto shrine, acts as the bridge between the present generation and its ancestors. Today, in any event, this priestly role is being made available to outside clients, as many a family office opens to the public. And of course, when you reach the fifth generation of family, with say 150 cousins, you essentially have multiple client families anyway. Here are some examples. Room 5600. This modest title covers a staff of 200 that manages the affairs of some 80 members of the Rockefeller family from a suite at the top of Rockefeller Center. It has been an extraordinarily secretive operation, which talks little to the press or anyone else. The rapacious original John D., who founded Standard Oil, made about $900 million, equivalent to perhaps $10 billion today. In 1934, his son John D. Jr. set up five trusts for his children of about $50 million each. These trusts today control 90% of Rockefeller Group Incorporated. The group has had four principal holdings: Rockefeller Center Properties Incorporated, which owned Rockefeller Center's complex of 16 buildings appraised at $2.6 billion, and Cushman & Wakefield Incorporated, the real estate company worth over $125 million. Also, there are Rockefeller Center Development Corporation, which holds properties outside Rockefeller Center itself. Rockefeller Center Telecommunications Corporation, and Radio City Music Hall Productions Incorporated. Outlet Company, which operates 7 TV and 4 radio stations, was bought in 1984 for $332 million and sold again in 1986 for over $600 million. The fourth main holding, Venrock Associates, a family venture capital limited partnership, runs about $150 million and has invested in both public and private companies. Every Rockefeller generation has tended to keep control for as long as possible. The third generation, for instance, yearned to escape the authority of their father, John D. Jr. The fourth generation have generally been kept on a tight leash, receiving only a fraction of the full income earned by their trusts. But there are now 22 of them, together with 50 or so in the fifth generation. All concerned were startled to find from a study done in 1983 that the income on total assets of the Rockefeller Group amounted to only 1% a year. One reason is that Rockefeller Center, the centerpiece of the family's wealth, traditionally had not been run to maximize profit. The center is said to have spent more money on maintenance per square foot than any other such office block in New York. Also, a number of long-term leases were signed in the early 1970s at roughly $26.50 per square foot, compared to twice that for recent leases in the area. And Radio City has lost money for decades. Every now and again, the family decides to close it, whereupon a vast neighborhood hubbub arises, and they relent. About the time this was sinking in, David Rockefeller, chairman of the Rockefeller Group Incorporated, hired Richard Vohl as president to try to turn things around. Vohl was a logical choice, since he had been active in the salvage of Penn Central, rationalizing its extensive real estate holdings and helping it to diversify into other businesses. Vohl proceeded to pull the Rockefeller Group back from several risky real estate commitments that had been in the works and jettisoned an oil and gas venture and a container company. The 1984 purchase of Outlet Company was financed largely through debt, as was a payment of $400 million to Columbia University for land under Rockefeller Center. So for a while, the debt service on these massive obligations largely devoured the group's cash income. To create some liquidity, Vohl turned to Rockefeller Center. An outright sale would have incurred estimated taxes of $400 million. Instead, he came up with one of the largest property financing transactions in history, a real estate investment trust called Rockefeller Center Properties Incorporated. The trust, which holds the original 12 Rockefeller Center buildings, sold $750 million in common stock plus $550 million in euro bonds, representing a total value of $1.3 billion. The Rockefellers are only one of many groups of New York real estate magnates that, while professing confidence in the future of Manhattan office buildings, had chosen this moment to admit the public as partners. In 1986, Vohl sold Outlet Company. With the profits, he paid down the group's debts. And in late 1989, a 51% stake in the Rockefeller Group was sold to the Mitsubishi Estate Company for $846 million, which will allow the family to further diversify their holdings. As I mentioned, Room 5600 has also formed a small internal trust company, and it is reasonable to expect that Rockefeller Trust will eventually seek outside clients. If it does, it will be imitating the family office of a rival clan, the Phippses. Bessemer Trust. Henry Phipps grew up next to Andrew Carnegie in Allegheny City, Pennsylvania. Henry Phipps was good at figures. He became an accountant for Carnegie, who was then building up his huge steel company and later was Carnegie's partner. Henry Phipps turned to philanthropy on an immense scale. Clinics, public baths, playgrounds, libraries. The next generation, however, had different concerns. They felt strongly that charity should begin and end at home. The Phipps children built palaces and polo fields. At one point, they owned a third of Palm Beach. All of this was organized financially under an extraordinary structure called the Family Plan. Henry Phipps placed nearly all the assets that he did not give away in a series of trusts. To manage each trust, he appointed a family instrument, Bessemer Trust Company of New Jersey, jointly with a family member. But Bessemer is in turn owned by the trusts it manages and is controlled by family members under a formula giving much greater authority to the older generations. Even more singular, the trusts themselves generally contain the main holding, Bessemer Securities, a Phipps family investing company, which buys stocks and bonds, real estate, oil and gas, venture capital deals, and so forth. Its shares can only be sold to other members of the family. Thus, there is no way a low-ranking member can have a direct say in the management of his own assets. Funded with $75 million in 1911, Bessemer Securities had by 1987 grown to $1.5 billion. Although that's an impressive figure, it actually works out to a bit over 3.7% per annum compounded after taxes and distribution. The personal services then offered by Bessemer were the most extensive of any family office. The office would open and close the house in Palm Beach, rush around the staff plumber if the toilet got stuck, mow the lawn and fix the roof, hire servants, and, of course, walk the dog if the family sailed off to Eleuthera. The rest of these services, which chiefly benefited the second and third generations, constituted, in effect, a large, unreported, and thus untaxed, dividend. By the time the family plan reached the fourth and fifth generations, however, restlessness emerged here and there. A 1957 study by auditors found a pattern of insider transactions among certain Bessemer trustees and executives. They also held that Bessemer had done much less well for its beneficiaries than an outside investment company might have. With that, a third-generation family member, Esmond B. Martin, began a legal struggle to extract his trust from the Bessemer structure. After a bad real estate investment in the early 1970s, Esmond Martin was joined by his first cousin, Winston Guest. Their legal efforts produced only modest results until 1974. In that year, Bessemer, to pay for its own modernization, sought to levy retroactive commissions on the trusts it managed. The ensuing brouhaha saw Martin and Guest joined by other relatives. This time, the result was a victory. A New Jersey court cut the commissions by almost half. During all this time, the family was paying millions of dollars a year more in taxes than it needed to. Because Bessemer's earnings were subject to corporate tax, followed by personal taxes when the money was distributed to the trusts. Then, in the early 1970s, Bessemer made a wise decision to bring in outside accounts. To see outsiders paying the same fees blunted the criticism of the less happy family members. Also, having a larger mass to work with both spreads the overhead and makes it possible to hire better people. In recent years, thanks to superior performance, good management, and a gilt-edged image, accounts under management have risen to some $5 billion. Fees from the Phipps trusts are only a third of the total. Bessemer's best performers have been its balanced portfolios, which have fared outstandingly well, followed by its equity accounts. Still, one piece of advice Bessemer, or for that matter, Room 5600, will probably never give its clients is to model their trust arrangements on the Phipps family plan. With the Phippses, and other wealthy families now offering to share their savvy with the needy rich, should one rush, funds permitting, to take advantage of this opportunity? Or should one look for a traditional investment counselor? I don't think there's a general answer. It requires individual analysis. The personal service aspect is easy to assess, like a hotel. But the investment side is much harder to evaluate. To evaluate investment success, you have to analyze how performance is achieved and then be knowledgeable enough to draw the conclusions. Not easy. Here are some general comments. To preserve capital, a family needs to give its best attention to how the problem is being handled, like a monarch supervising his government. Many a well-known family office has failed to do its job, and the family has dropped off the map. So a famous old name on a firm is not necessarily a guarantee of quality, only of price. Then, investing is ultimately an individual affair, not a collective one. You therefore need to get to know the individual investment decision maker and to possess enough familiarity with his craft to assess his decisions. Most skillful investors lose their superiority because they get too busy and become distracted. So the client needs to keep an eye on the key investment man, but not to the point of interfering with his work. Finally, an experienced person can usually tell when he's in the presence of a dedicated, keen, and able group, and when he's being skillfully soft-soaped. One day or another, almost all human enterprises reach the latter stage. The same is true of size. In the golden words of Professor C. Northcote Parkinson, growth means complexity, and complexity, decay. It's unlikely that anything very large will remain outstanding. To use Wall Street jargon, a structure tends to regress to the mean, to become bland and bureaucratic. It's time, then, to consider moving on. As we have seen, for the outsider, clubbing together with a rich family in a family office-turned-investment counsel firm should ensure that someone with clout is there following what's happening, and, one hopes, making management changes when necessary. But don't take that for granted. Peter Lynch, Relentless Pursuit. How can it be that a single individual, virtually without staff, and managing an enormous mass of capital, the $10 billion Magellan Fund, greatly outperforms large, able organizations handling only a fraction as much money? The chief reason is that a supremely capable individual, and Peter Lynch is one, easily outmaneuvers a large committee. Peter Lynch has two research assistants, one to collect Wall Street news and attend company presentations, and the other to call companies and go to research meetings. When asked if he mightn't like another, he responds vaguely. Perhaps, someday. You spend so much time talking to them. It also helps to be rather free with emoluments. Peter Lynch is a hired hand, but his employer, Fidelity Management, pays him several million dollars a year. Peter Lynch is one of the highest-paid portfolio investment employees in the world. But he is worth it many times over. Peter Lynch essentially created the Magellan Fund. Since he took charge in 1977, it has become the largest mutual fund in history, $12 billion in assets at its peak in August 1987, and $8.4 billion at March 1988. It has over a million shareholders and incidentally pays Fidelity, its managers, $60 million a year in management fees and as much as several million a year in sales commissions. $10,000 put in Magellan when Lynch took command in 1977 was worth over $200,000 by 1988. This investment prodigy is the son of a professor of mathematics at Boston College. His father died when he was 10, leaving the family in straitened circumstances. His mother went to work for a manufacturing company. Peter went from private school to a public school. Summers, he worked as a caddy, which is where he began hearing about the stock market. Businessmen out golfing exchange investment ideas, and some businessmen are very well informed. Young Peter sank $1,250 of his savings in one of the stocks he heard about, Flying Tiger Line, a way of riding the explosive growth of Pacific countries as well as the development of air freight. He bought in at $10. Flying Tiger went up and up. Peter sold some to get his money back and then sold more in dribbles all the way up. The last went in 1989 when the company was taken over by Federal Express. By the time he had cashed in most of his stocks, he had made enough money to pay for his graduate study at the Wharton School of Finance in Philadelphia. First, however, came college. Boston College had a partial scholarship intended precisely for caddies, which Peter won. In 1966, waiting to start in at Wharton, he got a summer job at Fidelity. There were 75 applicants, but Peter was the only one who had caddied for D. George Sullivan, the president of the company. In 1969, Lynch was offered a permanent job at Fidelity, starting as a metals analyst, and has worked there ever since. In 1974, after a few years in analytical jobs, Lynch became Fidelity's director of research, while continuing to cover the chemical, packaging, steel, aluminum, and textile industries. Such a job provides a marvelous chance to learn deeply about securities. One is essentially running an active think tank that maintains constant, systematic coverage of all of industry, endlessly visiting companies, then concentrating intensively on the most promising fish that turn up in the net. One's task is to develop opinions that over and over again are checked against actual results. Finally, one is constantly comparing one's ideas with those of one's peers in the same department, honing information and judgment. In 1977, Lynch, now 33, was put in charge of a little fund that Fidelity had around, the Magellan Fund. When Lynch took over, it had only $22 million in it, concentrated in relatively few holdings. By 1981, Magellan, then about $50 million, absorbed Fidelity's Salem Fund, which was of similar size. Lynch's cardinal advantage over the legion of his competitors, besides his basic talent, is simply the enormous dedication he brings to the task. Lynch tries harder. Indeed, one finds it rather exhausting just to think about his routine. In 20 years of marriage, he has taken two proper vacations. Most of his travels take him to visit companies around the world, and visit them he does. 40 or 50 a month, 500 or 600 a year. In this way, he has gotten to know hundreds upon hundreds of well-placed executives in the business world. In reverse, Lynch himself is a first port of call for companies that want to tell their stories to the Boston investment community. At any time, a score or so of companies will be in town to deliver their pitch. A key element of Lynch's technique is his insistence on first-hand contact with his sources. Fidelity has about 30 in-house analysts and many other portfolio managers. Lynch could rely on the information ingested and processed by this system, but he wants direct, regular contact with each company. Investment managers who don't do this basic spade work are, in Lynch's opinion, shirking their job. Lynch, who spends most of his day talking to companies on the telephone or personally, once said that either he or his research assistant checks with most of the companies he holds once a month. Some investors hope that they can sit at their desks with their computer screens and brokerage write-ups and do an adequate job. Big bucks in the comfort of your own home. Alas, it is not that simple. The real pro begins from that level of knowledge. To compete, you have to make use of every instrument available, the key one being first-hand knowledge. Lynch hates it when a broker recommends a stock without providing good reasons. He ignores the broker's record of previous successes and treats such a recommendation as though it had been slipped anonymously under the door. He wants the background, so he visits the company's plants. You can't do it secondhand. Lynch's endless quest, his endless search among companies, is directed above all toward the obvious winner, based on changes in the key variable. As he goes back repeatedly to a given company or industry, he spots changes. Business has been dreadful for a year. Then it's not quite so bad. Perhaps inventories are coming down. He learns of something afoot that will change things, a better regulatory climate, a new product or service. So he starts to buy, but not just the top company in the group. Like James Rogers, he buys the entire group, quite possibly dozens of companies. Then, as they start to move, he may winnow the list down to a favorite few. Lynch claims that if other investors made as many calls as he did, they too would spot the changes in company fortunes that he does. You have to stay tuned, he often says. There are, of course, a couple of differences between Lynch and most investors. He has a sure enough grasp of the material to be able to act swiftly and smoothly without troubling to get more facts than necessary, just enough to be right most of the time. Also, Lynch can evaluate and develop buying and selling targets all across the range of his huge repertoire of actual and possible holdings. In that way, he's exposed to far more opportunities than most investors. Most fund managers reason that since knowing more than the competition is the key to superiority, they will focus on a limited area. Lynch's technique is to be prepared to deal in practically any stock. And while Lynch has access to Fidelity's research, he makes all his own decisions. Quite surprising in my experience of notable investors is Peter Lynch's balanced, calm, and modest approach to his profession and life, except, of course, for his phenomenally intense preoccupation with his work. Those around him all praise his relaxed and unassuming manner. Lynch is a bit over 6 feet tall, slim and athletic-looking, with silver hair over a pale, finely modeled, almost spiritual face. He speaks rapidly and profusely. The essence of Lynch is fluency, letting his portfolio flow easily from one idea to another. He notices some apparent opportunity in the market and moves on it without delaying for extensive analysis. This requires both flair and sure judgment based on long experience of the subject. Lynch, detecting a market inefficiency, will act immediately. The domestic car companies seem cheap. He buys Ford, Chrysler, and GM. They go up. He adds a collection of foreign ones, Volvo, Subaru, Honda, and Fiat. The relative positions change again. He calmly reverses field. Since, like a racing skipper, he is constantly changing course to take advantage of small shifts in the wind, there is unending movement in Lynch's portfolio. Many holdings only last a month or two, and the entire list turns over at least once a year on average. Lynch feels that if he were doing his job perfectly, the turnover would be even greater. Lynch believes in an old trader's rule. If you buy a stock because you hope something will happen, and it doesn't happen, sell the stock. Lynch says he often sells too soon. But, he says, you don't get hurt by things that you don't own that go up. It's what you do own that kills you. Growth for Lynch is, of course, a cardinal virtue in a company, and growth stocks are the largest single category in his portfolio. However, in talking about growth, Lynch looks particularly at unit growth, even more than earnings growth. Lynch looks for rising numbers of physical units sold, quarter by quarter, year by year. The very best way to make money in a market, Lynch says, is in a small growth company that has been profitable for a couple of years and simply goes on growing. Unlike many investors, Lynch loves simple businesses that anybody could run. Other investors often prefer the top businesses with wonderful managements in highly competitive areas. But for Lynch, the crux is that you don't need to insist on anything wonderful, just a good enough company that's selling too low and won't fall apart before the stock moves back up to where it belongs. Lynch has almost no inhibitions about the kind of company in which he invests. We've seen him buying funeral homes and motels. Many of his favorites have names that old-fashioned folk might find disconcerting. These companies are much more solid than they sound. The Pep Boys is a Philadelphia auto parts supplier. It is 75 years old and still getting stronger, so it's not strange that Lynch thinks well of it. International Dairy Queen has some 7,000 outlets around the country. It uses its earnings to buy back its own stock. Lynch says that he has an edge because a lot of the people he competes with are not looking for reasons to buy. They're looking for reasons not to buy. The company is unionized. GE will come out with a competitive product, whatever. There's a whole list of biases that scare most investors away from studying the situation at all. To make money, says Lynch, you must find something that nobody else knows or do something that others won't do because they have rigid mindsets. Lynch has a brusque, common-sense contempt for many, if not most, of the formulas that are peddled as shortcuts to stock market success. Likewise, weighty punditry on economics and market analysis. I spend about 15 minutes a year on economic analysis, he says. The way you lose money in the stock market is to start off with an economic picture. I also spend 15 minutes a year on where the stock market is going. All these great, heady, thinking deals kill you. Lynch notices that people always ask him about the outlook for the economy and the stock market and other such large and general questions. But nobody can give those answers. And even if they could, companies like Procter & Gamble or Colgate should not be affected by such fluctuations. If instead one buys a company that has inherent problems, one can lose all one's money, even in good times. The GNP 6 months out is just malarkey, he says. How's the sneaker industry doing? That's real economics. Completing his repudiation of conventional trust company practice, which based on economic overview puts a portfolio into categories, cyclicals, utilities, and the like, and massages them by computer, Lynch entirely avoids conscious asset allocation, either between stocks and revenues or between industrial sectors. He does, however, have a framework for his portfolio that is quite original. Among stocks, he has four conceptual categories. He had been running the Magellan Fund for 3 or 4 years before some outside shareholders who studied the portfolio pointed out to him what the different categories of holdings were. He had not originally bought the holdings to fit into the categories. 1. Growth companies on which he would hope to make 2 or 3 times his cost over time. 2. Underpriced asset plays, value stocks, or smaller blue chips. He is looking for a rapid gain of a third or so, after which he is likely to move on promptly. 3. Special situations and depressed cyclicals. 4. Defensive stocks, which he holds in preference to cash. Lynch never holds actual cash or cash equivalents. Rather, he holds conservative stocks with substantial yields in stable industries. They should not be too affected by economic downturns and should hold up in market declines, although they lag during market rises. This group, since he is not looking for big gains, is also where his highest turnover occurs. Will Lynch offer a guess as to the best prospects for stock market happiness over the coming years? Yes. The price-earning ratios of growth stocks range between the same as the standard industrials and twice the standard industrials. Recently, the growth stocks have been selling at the same price-earnings multiple as the standard industrials, so they apparently have plenty of room to move up. In Lynch's words, I would think you'd be better off with good quality, medium-sized, and smaller growth companies. To sum up the whole matter, Lynch is obsessed with the stock market. His wife was quoted in an article that on their first date, his entire conversation was about stocks and the stock market. Great success, alas, usually requires obsession. In March 1990, perhaps mindful that his father had died at exactly the same age he had reached, Lynch gave up his obsession when he quit his job at Magellan, leaving an unmatched record in managing very large portfolios. In conclusion, there are basically three ways to do unusually well in the stock market. First, buy stocks that are cheap and sell them when they are reasonably priced. Value investing. Second, buy into companies that will grow and grow and grow and stay along for the ride. Third, discover a whole new investment area. The growth investment techniques described in my earlier study, The Money Masters, remain valid for the masters in this one, but some of the value investment techniques are different. The great value investors in The Money Masters often have a 4-year buy-sell cycle. For some of today's masters, however, the cycle is much shorter, as little as a few months, or whatever time it takes for a purchase to attain a previously calculated price level. A technique we find in these investors might be called relentless pursuit, constantly scanning the herd for new stocks to pick off for limited moves rather than as long-term commitments. The relentless pursuit technique can only be practiced successfully by authentic masters at the height of their powers. The non-professional can scarcely aspire to that degree of skill, and supposing wrongly that he has, it may be expensive. Many investors, such as James Rogers, hunt constantly for trend changes they can take advantage of, the top-down approach. He and others look primarily to the world outside their door. More Japanese motorcycles? Fiber optics? A new regulatory environment. One then checks with industry sources and starts investigating particular companies. The other method of catching trend changes is that of Peter Lynch, whose endless talks with the companies themselves will reveal changes at their own level, the bottom-up approach. Either way, though, it is change that the investor hopes to observe and take advantage of before his competitors. A surprising number of the greatest investors develop new investment areas like an art collector who finds and exploits an overlooked category. It has always been possible in the past to notice neglected techniques or neglected areas of investment. The listener can reasonably ask if there are any today. Yes, I see several. One that seems obvious is selling short, particularly now that there is no tax penalty as compared to capital gains. Someone who understands the values can see clearly enough when the market capitalization of a company or a class of companies is wildly in excess of what an experienced private business should be willing to pay for the same merchandise to be held as an investment. So in due course, there should be a short side opportunity here. A mistaken judgment can cost the short seller a fortune as a large position goes heavily against him. To this, one counter is the technique of great diversification. When selling short stocks that are crazily overpriced, one should have the widest possible diversification. And if you limit your shorts to 1% positions, you can contemplate the bubblings in the cauldron with less concern. Even then, selling short is an extremely disquieting activity, which should only be undertaken by professionals. Still, I would think that in the future, there would be more limited partnerships conducting this specialty. What else? At one time, farmland ranked as a prime conservative investment. It still does today in some countries abroad. A large part of American agriculture, together with its bankers, is in desperate straits. And yet, as James Rogers has observed of other industries, there can't be an America without farmers. So agriculture almost has to be made more attractive. But again, as I can attest from experience, it is a difficult game, only for highly experienced, hands-on professionals. So buying raw agricultural land, not operating farms, seems safest. One can take it as a general rule that what was once in fashion will again be in fashion. So with an open mind, you usually can find opportunities. All investment opportunity consists of the difference between the value and the perception, That is, if you can find something tradable that is seriously mispriced, you can make a profit. So with any of these strategies, the cardinal rule is that you must understand the values. This starts, of course, with fully studying and understanding the basic figures of any company that you invest in. All too many investors do not know the average age of the plants of a company they buy, or their depreciation rates, or how its inventory turnover compares with its competitors. In addition to the figures, first-hand knowledge of the companies themselves is essential. The investor who can't spare the time for that work should hire someone else to invest for him. One might conclude that while it is very difficult to copy the techniques of a Peter Lynch, for instance, one could well buy a piece of his action by investing in the Magellan Fund while he was still running it. In other words, aren't selected funds a satisfactory solution? They can be. Fund management is one of the few areas in life where the good often costs no more than the bad, and sometimes less. But there are now more funds available to the bewildered investor than there were stocks on the New York Stock Exchange when I entered the business. So, how to go about choosing? First, one must find an appropriate fund for the season. Don't buy a growth fund just after there has been a big run-up in those stocks. Buy a fund in an investment sector that is out of favor at the time. Very few funds indeed are superior over many successive time periods. Second, to speak of a fund is misleading. There is one individual behind it all. Make sure that the key man is still at his post and doing what he has always done best in the same way as before. Third, shun excessive costs. Never buy a load fund, one sold with a commission. Fourth, a good small fund, 100 million say, will ordinarily do significantly better for you than a big one. An outstanding fund will get so big it becomes mediocre. There is one situation in which investment through funds is almost indispensable, covering sectors in which one could not otherwise, as a practical matter, participate. These might include the Far East and the world of high technology. No lay investor can be expected to know how to invest on a remote continent or in a business world beyond his experience. So, I would say that for most listeners, an interesting approach might be to conduct systematic growth and/or value investment on one's own while using specialized funds for specialized purposes. One technique that a listener should find congenial is to buy stocks from among those favored by outstanding fund managers. Use the masters as a filter. They constantly scan each other's portfolios, so there's no reason not to do the same. None of the masters in this book relies on the tools so beloved of pundits: regression analysis, modern portfolio theory, technical analysis, or higher math. They focus on the specific rather than on overviews and big ideas. They essentially attempt to render general, simple, and easy what is intrinsically specific, complicated, and hard. Successful investing means knowing all about the companies you own. So look to the particular. Let others be distracted by the generalities, the formulas, the simplifications. Alfonso the Learned modestly observed that had he been present at the creation, he would have given God some useful hints for the better ordering of the universe. My own would be that our species is much too easily seduced by vast ideas, particularly in politics, but also in the stock market, the encephalogram of the human race. Our hopes and fears for the future are reflected in those wiggly lines. Most of the time, however, vast, unknowable ideas distract from the specific and knowable. So don't spend too much time on next year's GNP. As Peter Lynch says, how is the sneaker business? That's real economics. This tape is a guide to investment success. But my last message to the listener is this: understand the process, but don't try too hard yourself. The people who sustain the worst losses are usually those who overreach. And it's not necessary. Steady, moderate gains will get you where you want to go. Furthermore, trying to achieve great wealth, that is, far more than you need, is in fact irrational. You have to give up too much getting there. Midas is ruined by the gold he craves. And great wealth spoils ordinary human contacts. Everybody wants something. Of the Rothschilds, in their pride, it was said that they had no friends, only clients. Indeed, the hurly-burly of humanity, from which great wealth insulates itself, its joys and trials, is what we're made for. The rational approach is to trust in a sufficiency of wealth as a byproduct of a useful life. Happy are those who find fulfillment in their families, their work, and their civic duties, and hope for the best.